Welcome, friends, to another episode of the DTFH. If you're a fan of the Midnight Gospel, you probably remember Clancy's meditation teacher, David. Well, David happens to be Duncan's meditation teacher, too, in Meet Space, and he has joined us here today for a fascinating conversation about Buddhism, attachment, and letting go. If you like David and you're interested in going deeper, I want to invite you to join David on February 10th for a free live online event exploring the profound practices of mindfulness and the journey of becoming a meditation teacher. All the links are going to be down below, or you can go to dharmamoon.com to find that. So I hope you will check him out if you enjoy him. We've been friends now for years and years, and he is certainly one of the coolest people I know. I hope you'll enjoy him too. So please welcome back to the DTFH, David Nichtern. David, welcome back to the DTFH. It's good to see you. I love your background.
Good to see you too. Good to see you, Papa Bear.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm breeding. I'm a breeding bird. Living things crawl on me every moment that I come home. It's either kids or dogs. Not the wife so much. But
how many dogs do you have?
Two.
And four kids, right?
Four kids, two dogs.
I mean, that's a full house, right?
It is a full house. Yeah, it's a full house. Lots of energy in there, you know. Yeah. But you know what's interesting about it is, like, the me before I became a householder couldn't stand being around anybody. You know, now it really doesn't bother me. You know, I mean, it's annoying, of course, to always have something climbing on top of you. But it's not like it would have been catastrophic to that other version of me. It's just fascinating the way people can just shift according to your circumstances, you know?
You know how they keep those helium balloons down on Earth, right?
What do you mean?
Well, you know, it tends to rise.
Oh, yes.
And go up into the stratosphere, but they put sandbags on it with little faces of kids and dogs and jobs and bank accounts mortgages, and
there you
every
go.
Sandbag has a little face on it, you know?
Yeah, it keeps you it definitely keeps you in the earth plane and all the but you it does seem like that's sort of an illusion too, right? Like when you start distinguishing, well, this is earth, this is sky.
Sure.
Isn't that a bit of a confusion there? Isn't that a bit of a distorted perception of things?
It's dualistic.
Yeah, dualistic.
But, you know, we talk about this. We end up on this topic so often about the absolute and relative dimensions of things.
I lost your audio for 1 second. Say that again. No, I'm not sure what that was. It was just a little blip.
You good now?
Yeah, we're good.
It puts you into a kind of relational truth modality. And for us, for the kind of journeyers that we are, the kind of practitioners we are, that's sort of adventitious.
Advantageous. No,
that too.
But
adventitious means opportunistic, doesn't
it? Ah, okay, I see what you're saying. So you're saying that sort of within that distinction, there's some sort of energy or something you can get out of that.
Well, I'll give you an example. There was one of the great Rinpoches was visiting in New York, and they were asking about, you know, is there life on other planets and things like that?
Yeah.
And he said, there are billions of planets and life all over the place, but this is an incarnation on Earth is considered particularly auspicious and good.
Hold on, David. Do you have a compressor on your mic or something? Because you're fading in and out on me. Or maybe just turn your mic audio up a little bit. I'm losing words. So it sort of sound, and then like that.
Is that any better?
Yeah. We'll see what happens.
Is it louder?
It's louder. That should do it.
Okay. you let me know.
Start with a Rinpoche anecdote again.
Yeah. So I won't say who, but one of the, you know, Tibetan Rinpoches was asked about, you know, kind of different life on other planets and things like that. And he said, you know, almost matter-of-factly, of course, there's tons of it. But that this, an incarnation in Earth, is considered particularly auspicious because it's a great place to work through your karma.
Right. Yeah, it's like that. That's an so okay. So this is really interesting. I'd love to know your thoughts on that, because there are all these strange places where Buddhist mysticism and some fairly like weirdly popular, like I don't know what you'd even call it, like neo-Gnostic ideas emerge into the culture. They're everywhere right now. One of them being that Earth is like a prison situation. That prison in the sense that, well, you're shaking your head, but it doesn't that kind of align with the Buddhist conceptualization of samsara and no longer taking on birth at all, and that Earth is sort of it doesn't just have physical gravity; it has a sort of spiritual gravity field that keeps you stuck in these sort of looping cycles. And so it sounds like the Rinpoche is talking about is like, you know, it's not so much a prison as a university, a training academy or something like that. But you could just as easily say you can get out of prison if you on good behavior. You can, you know, if you sort of harmonize with the Dharma or whatever the particular right modality of living is, then there is some hope of no longer hanging out here in this realm.
Where would you like to be?
What's that?
Where would you like to be?
Well, I like it here. I mean, I like it. I'm happy here. Right. But I might just, you know, sometimes I wonder, well, maybe that's just because you're a fool. I mean, what I'm saying is when I look back at before I had kids, I was happy, you know, a different kind of happy, but I guess happy. When I look back before then, as far as I can remember, there's always some threat of happiness intermingled with a threat of suffering. So I don't know. I'd probably be happy theoretically. I don't know. I often wonder, like, if I was in hell, would I be like, well, it's not the worst place. Maybe I'm just a fool.
Well, whether one is or not, the notion, clearly, since we're referencing the Buddhist framework, is that the most important element in the sense of liberation is one's own mind.
Right.
Rather than the physical locus of the body.
Right.
You know? So, you know, and that can be ranging from having a good attitude when you go to the dentist.
Yes.
And not torturing yourself for the whole week before you go.
Right.
You know, and then, you know, the amount of mental, you know, confabulation of fabrication of construction that's happening in our minds could make a prison into a university and a university into a prison.
A prison into a university, university into a prison. You're still fading in and out a little bit. You know what? Can you turn it just to your max recorder instead of your headphones? State of mind is the determining factor in one's encounter with reality.
Well, for example, whether you consider the situation samsaric, nirvanic, or neutral, wouldn't you say day by day that really is a heavy reflection or mirror-like reflection of your state of mind?
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%.
So that's what we work on.
Yeah, 100%. And that's where to go back to what we were talking about in the beginning, that's where I guess I would get into a question regarding that distinction between earth and sky, because somewhere there that distinction seems to stop existing in such a clear way. Because, you know, from my own fascination with sky mind, which is a term David uses, I think another way to put it might be like the, you know, astral realm, things not of this earth, expanding one's consciousness, taking shit tons of acid to try to merge in with all reality. You know what I mean? There's all these different outlets that aren't meditative that one could use to at least get fleeting temporary glimpses of a kind of non-self-centered fixed reality. And one of the most available to people is psychedelics. And so what starts happening when you begin to realize your a shifting of one's own perception, or even deeper than that, when you start realizing you're sort of looking at your mind around you, you know, that you can't get out of your mind, you're inside your mind at any given moment. To me, the earth realm stuff, it becomes a little less solid, I guess is the best way to put it.
Yeah. So the sky dimension is spaciousness, you know, unobstructed spaciousness, which is a more of a kind of
This episode of the DTFH is brought to you by ExpressVPN. Friends, going online without a VPN, you might as well do that thing. And I've seen people do it, and it's disgusting. They run their hands down the side of an escalator. You ever seen that, Josh? It's so gross. They just slide their hands down the side of an escalator. No gloves. Are you kidding? All that shop and sweat. And germs, disease. It would be better for you to go find a moldering casket in a cursed cemetery to stick your hand in a witch's heart. Don't go online without a VPN. That's all I'm saying. You shouldn't do that. My God, you realize how much you're being tracked and watched the moment you turn your VPN on. It cuts all that bullshit off. It's crazy. You're like a shaggy dog running through some tick-filled forest when you're on the internet without a VPN. Just getting all these bugs and lice and ticks and fleas and rodents and little biting gnats attached to you. VPNs, they fix that. They fix the problem. Also, it's fascinating how you could just make yourself appear in any location you want at any time. And that can be useful for a lot of things that you might enjoy on the internet. I use ExpressVPN. I used them before they sponsored me. Now that they sponsor me, it's fantastic. I continue to use them. They've got the lowest price ever. You can get it for just $3.49 a month. It's just 12 cents a day. It would take a hacker with a supercomputer over a billion years to get past ExpressVPN's encryption, and this is the most important thing for this old dog. It's easy to use. It's no bullshit. You just turn it on. It works. Where do you want to be? You want to say you're in Los Angeles? You're in Los Angeles. That's what the internet thinks. And it just works. It works flawlessly. I've never had a problem with it. And I can barely use my remote control. So that means that anyone can use it. Secure your online data today by visiting expressvpn.com/Duncan. That's expressvpn.com/Duncan to find out how you can get up to 4 extra months. expressvpn.com/Duncan.
Attitude, you could say, or kind of a, you know, view, right? Mm-hmm. The earth is sort of like there's stuff to deal with, but it's workable.
Yeah.
And then we talk about joining heaven and earth all the time, which is to mix the spaciousness with the four kids and the two dogs, yeah, and the wife in whatever mode she's manifesting for your benefit, and to see if you can mix some spaciousness in with that form realm, and if you can also not get attached to the vagueness and voidness of the spaciousness, so right, that it it has a kind of fungible and, you know, a realistic kind of dimension for you. And yeah. then that would be non-dual. If you've joined heaven and earth, there's a sense of like not really needing to hyperemphasize that distinction at that point. You're integrated.
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting place, that integration. Because
yes,
the, you know, the spacious POV, as you were calling it.
Yeah, POV, good, yeah.
The spacious POV, it's nice. If only that was it. But inevitably, if you're wandering around Earth, there's shit that has to be done. You've got to feed yourself. It's almost like a cosmic joke. We have to shit. We have to eat. And we can either get too cold or too hot, forcing an infinite loop of action if you want to stay alive. And we want to stay alive. That's the main thing.
Wait, because I think this is a highly conceptualized framework of it. For example, personally, myself, I ate a nice bowl of yogurt this morning, and yeah, right before I talked to you, I did have a shit.
Yeah, good.
And no problem.
Oh, yeah, no problem. I'm not saying that's right. A problem.
Right.
I'm just saying that these are things that I'm assuming black holes don't have to worry about. You know what I mean? A black hole isn't like, I've got to eat another star. Holy yeah. Shit. It's hard.
I see.
You know what
so
I mean?
There's you're talking about an attraction to that kind of vastness and
absolutely.
Yeah. So one thing to consider about that, I can understand that, is that an attraction to that, an attachment to that, actually lands you in the God realm in terms of the six realms, not in the sense of spaciousness, because there's a very dualistic relationship with it, which you're describing.
Because you're running away from something.
You're trying, yeah, exactly, or you're trying to get closer to something else, you know, it's like,
yeah.
So that would be the subtle twist of this spaciousness, is that it can, if you could say the same thing for the drugs and so forth, that there's an attraction, a draw towards being drawn towards this kind of unobstructed and kind of spacious, universal kind of thing, and you become addicted, basically.
I have noticed an attraction to drugs in my life. But this I think what's really beautiful of the Buddhist, what's beautiful about the Buddhist framework, is that you do sort of get a little bit of a surprise party. I guess I wouldn't want to call it that, because I would never want a surprise party. But you do get this sort of experience if you are someone who has been attracted to the God realm stuff.
Right.
When you start realizing, oh, wow, I don't necessarily have to, you know, go through all of these sometimes expensive, sometimes dangerous, sometimes embarrassing trips to get to this place. This place is sort of omnipresent and within the whole picture. It's not like it's in some corner of reality that you have to trek towards. It's not like you have to get on a helicopter to get to Everest and then hire a bunch of Sherpa to get in line to get to the top of a peak that is covered in human excrement to have some sense of
spaciousness. Yeah. Yeah, I think you understand it, right?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why Buddha's touching the earth as sort of a directional vortex for, serious spiritual practitioners, maybe make contact with common sense, with the grounded reality that you experience as being a seat of wisdom and an opportunity to manifest wisdom and compassion, all the good qualities.
Well, for me, where I guess that part of me that loves drugs and is, you know, drawn towards, I hate the term, paranormal, strange, high weirdness.
Yeah. Sure.
It becomes really interested in experimenting with the malleability of earth realm stuff, not from the normal sort of way you can move Earth Realm stuff around, but from, you know, how if this is my mind, which I'm fairly certain it could be, and I can control my dreams, and clearly if I stop hissing at the Earth Realm, it stops hissing at me. You know, there's a direct relationship in my state of mind and how the world seems to function and operate. That's where it gets interesting to me, because you just start wondering, wait a minute, like, how much of this can I control? How much of this can anyone control, for that matter? How impressionable is reality, not from the normal perspective of, you know, lift up a rock, stack a rock on top of the rock, you're going to get a stack of rocks. We all know that works. And that is your mind doing that. You're controlling your body with your mind. But how, I guess what I'm saying is, there's some sense when you start stumbling upon this knowledge that magic could be quite real, that a lot of the stories you hear about miracles and cities are probably not bullshit.
Yeah. So as we're talking about this, I'm thinking about a practice that my teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, wrote called the Sadhana of Mahamudra, which is a liturgy that's you practice and you recite it. And there's one phrase in it that bubbled up into my mind as we're talking, but you won't find ordinary earth and rocks here, even if you look for them.
Yeah.
And then it goes on to say all the rivers, all the mountains are actually the sacred world.
Yeah.
And so it's not, we're not saying that earth is kind of, from that perspective, it's not disappointing. It's wonderful. And also challenging, which, do you want to live challenge free? That's okay. You go to the God realm for a couple of eons. No challenge.
It just feels like the what you're talking about, that facet of reality, it's hiding from you as much as you're hiding from you. Like the degree.
Exactly as much.
Yeah, exactly as much. And yeah. And the less you're hiding from yourself, the more it shows you. This sort of as above, so below relationship, it applies to everything. That, and this is the dream, you know, this is the archetype in so many different stories. Gandalf shows up at the Hobbit's house. The adventure begins. A treasure map is found, leading to, you know, an incredible journey. You go through a wardrobe, you're in some other realm. The looking glass, you know, you go through the looking glass.
Sure.
All of these are different ways that, you know, creatives have articulated what I think what we're talking about, which is, number one, the absurdity. I guess I'm just talking about this because I've been watching this incredible documentary that you should watch. You will love it. It's called Miru. It's on Netflix. It's about these super professional mountain climbers, alpinists, as they call themselves. And so, you know, they look down on people who climb Everest. This is bullshit. You can hire people. It's bullshit.
Is that literally they look down?
They don't really. Oh, I didn't mean it like a dad joke, but that's hilarious.
No, I meant.
That's so bad. But no, they're just sort of like, they were just saying like, look, with Everest, you hire people. You can hire people to set up your tent. You can hire people to carry your shit. You hire people to. This is about them trying to be the first people to climb Mount Meru, which apparently no one has made the ascent. And I just love watching these adventure docs, but it's incredible because they are really describing this zone of risk that professional mountain climbers are disciplined to not go beyond, which is why they stay alive. In other words, it doesn't matter. If you're one inch out of this zone of safety, you don't do it. So, spoiler, skip ahead 3 seconds. It starts off with them making this ascent. They're within 600 feet of the peak of Mount Meru. They could see it. It's right there, right above them. But, yeah, they couldn't do it because it was getting dark, and they're like, we're not climbing that at night, and we're tired. We'll die. And so they just look at each other and like, and just, yeah, start heading back down. But the reason that...
That sounds like the record business.
It's like a lot of things. It's a lot of things are like that. But I'm only bringing it up because here you have these, they're all incredible people. Like you could just see their vibrance and their connection with the natural world and their complete fearlessness. Like they are so tuned into the reality. They might not come back. They might die. Yeah. Their friends have died. And so there's a mystical quality to them, but
isn't it also a little like those guys who surf the 100-foot waves? Isn't it a similar?
Yeah, I had one on my podcast. But
really?
Yeah, but you're sitting around in your comfortable house with all your kids and your dogs, and from the what we're talking about, there's some sense where I'm thinking, I don't feel like I need to buy $100,000 worth of climbing gear and ascend a peak to get to the place I think that they're going for. Now, that just might be wishful thinking. I don't know, because
four kids is by far a taller peak to climb.
I feel like that. I feel like that because I feel like it does. But I don't think that you need four kids or a mountain. I think you just, if you have, you know, two arms, two legs, and a head, a brain, a nervous system, that's enough. You're contending with enough just from that perspective. And that's what I love about, you know, what you've taught me and, you know, what I've gathered from the Buddhist path is that it sort of opens up that for everybody without necessarily having to spend shit tons of money flying a bunch of planes to get there.
Yeah, and also there's some flip of beginning to respect your karma, that the situation that you're in, the time you're born in, not struggling to live a different life, you know, only this, only that. But working with the energies of the situations that have sort of arisen for you is a kind of, you know, real wisdom in that.
Yeah.
You know, not trying to postulate some extreme circumstance in which you could become enlightened or whatever you want to talk about. But that the very circumstances that you're in has everything that you need. If you are able to have the right set of tools to work with it in a way that illuminates the process of your own mind.
Okay, let's talk about that, what you just said, because I love it. Because this is definitely a hilarious thing that creeps into my mind. I'm sure it creeps into many people's minds, which is, you know, I'll be, I don't know, at the sink washing dishes or something.
Infinite dishes. 108,000 dishes, right?
Washing dishes.
Right.
Somewhere in the house, there's a howl of who knows what's happened, a scream from one of the kids, and the dogs are barking, and the doorbell rings, and the dogs bark more. And I'll think to myself, you know, this wasn't supposed to happen to me. I was supposed to be in a monastery. I was supposed to be sitting by a waterfall somewhere, or, you know, the just what you said. I postulate the preconditions of enlightenment, and they always happen to be somewhere far away from where I'm at. This fantasy of assembling this sort of peaceful conglomerate of things around me, at which point I guess I get enlightened. And now I see this as just utter horseshit, but I wonder if you could talk about that a little more, because I think so many people look at their lives, where they're at right now, they look around and they think, this ain't no Bodhi tree. There's no, I'm not out in the woods. I'm not, I haven't done the fasting. You can't circle my spine with your... I haven't emaciated myself. I haven't had visions of the great angels or devas or gods. I'm never getting there in this place. And then they try to run.
But you have done stand-up comedy.
True. True.
And yeah. They haven't.
Yeah, that's true. But don't you know what I mean? This is, I think, one of the poisons that creeps in is a direct result of encountering any of these paths that have at their nucleus a being who went through severe austerities of one sort or another to achieve realization, or an orbit around them of other enlightened beings who also lived non-standard lives. It haunts people who come to this stuff in the midst of what from the outside might be looked at as a fairly normal, standard human life.
Yeah. Beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, because you're hitting a nail on a head and you're realizing it appears to be two nails, but it might be one nail. And that's the thing, is that from the, and just strictly doctrinally speaking, as a Buddhist student and practitioner, the teaching would say you do not need those circumstances to achieve that kind of realization. And there have been many iterations of householder pathways towards what you're talking about. They require a kind of discipline in post-meditation practice. You hold the view in your post-meditation practice.
What's meditation?
So meditation has
kidding,
a lot of...
David,
it's
kidding.
A great question, and a lot of people would say a lot of different things about it.
Yeah,
it's
I'm
like,
sorry.
You know, remember that movie Rashomon, which had the different perspectives in the forest?
I never saw it.
A murder is committed. Anyhow, the long story short is everybody's going to have something different to say about this. But I can say something about it, that one of the generative terms about meditation in Tibetan is GOM, G-O-M, which simply means to become familiar with something.
Yeah.
So you have a sense of having an individual consciousness, right? And you're placing that on a particular object of perception and trying to get to understand it better.
Yeah.
For example, you could be placing it on the breath, right? Mm. And so now you're just feeling the breath. You're feeling through that, you're feeling the quality of present awareness, which is easier to access because you only have one thing to work on, one equation to work on. And you're also noticing, you know, the activity in the mind, which is something we don't always notice, that the mind is kind of like doing this and fluttering and telling stories. And you're noticing that without judging it, which is nobody's ever done.
Right.
That's complete science fiction from the point of view of the average person.
Right. Right.
But you just notice what your mind is generating.
Right.
And not try to manipulate or judge it.
Right.
So as you know, in our trainings, this is the hardest job we have, is to turn the course of study from everything else to just having a clear view of what one's mind is generating without judgment or manipulation.
Right.
So that's interesting in itself. So meditation is the art of becoming familiar with reality and with your own mind in a very direct way. And so it includes a lot of different techniques, for example, different methods. Some of them have more focus and kind of intentionality. And some of them are a little bit more open, you know, just like, you know, just feel the space or something like that, you know.
Right.
Depends on the mind of the student or the person who's practicing it. What are they going to be able to connect with?
Right.
It's fly fishing, Duncan.
Right. Yeah,
From a teacher's point of view, it's fly fishing. You catch them, you throw them back.
That's cool. That's cool. Yeah.
But you have to have a lure that looks like something that they would want to bite into. Right.
So somewhere along the way, you find a practice and you dig in.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and then it happens, you know, something will happen that is, you know, initially extraordinary. And whether you, and you know, from my perspective, I know that there's the way this is talked about is carefully. It can be confusing, but you know, I cracked open an old grimoire. I have my favorite book of magic, Crowley's Liber 4, and I almost brought it to read The opening of the book is prior to the getting into the magical systems, is really an incredible course in meditation. That's the opening of the book. This is the first you have to deal with your mind before any of this other bullshit. Start with your mind. And I was curious your thoughts on one point he made, which is that Buddha is in India. This episode of the DTFH has been supported by Ethos as a maximum level breeder. I gotta have life insurance. Like, look at me. If I kick the bucket, I'm leaving four beautiful children and a wife in just a precarious, terrible shit situation. Now, maybe you're one of those people who's sick of life insurance commercials, or you hear it and you're like, so you just don't want to listen to it. I used to be one of those people, honestly. But I got to tell you, the moment somehow my old ass got a life insurance policy, you just feel better. It's weird how much you attach to dying that doesn't have anything to do with you. And how much you, like, some part of you recognizes, like, if you kick the bucket, what happens to your family? I'm not trying to scare you guys or anything. I'm just saying some weird magic happens when you get life insurance. You just strangely feel a little less freaked out about kicking the bucket. Ethos, forgive me. I'm not sure if that's exactly what you wanted me to say, but that's the truth. That is how I feel. Ethos makes getting life insurance fast and easy. It's 100% online. You can get a quote in seconds, apply in minutes, and get same-day coverage. There's no medical exam, which is incredible. When I got life insurance, I can't tell you how much blood I had to give. It was insane. You just answer a few simple health questions. You can get up to $3 million in coverage. Some policies are as low as $30 a month. And as of March 2025, Business Insider named Ethos the number one no medical exam instant life insurance provider. Ethos has 4.8 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot with over 3,000 reviews. Protect your family with life insurance from Ethos now by going to ethos.com/Duncan. In as little as 10 minutes, you can get your free quote and up to $3 million in coverage at ethos.com/Duncan. That is ethos.com/Duncan. ethos.com/Duncan. Application times and rates may vary. Thank you, Ethos. Figures out a good, well, he's talking about postures, finds a good meditation posture, goes into a deep meditation, has an extraordinary experience, which people call enlightenment. This experience, non-different from the experience that Jesus had or from the experience that any other person had, except that that experience gets populated with the gods, deities, ways of articulating it according to the times. So Jesus, he starts talking about some, you know, Jewish desert god. It's the best way he can articulate this experience. Buddha's story is Mara and, you know, all of these things. The best way he could articulate, it's like he's going to talk about it in the cultural language of some other part of the world. But the experience itself, identical. Arjuna, Bhagavad Gita, when Krishna reveals the universal form. This is another depiction of the identical phenomena, which happens the moment you are no longer encumbered by the mind. And I was just wondering your thoughts on that. Do you think he's on point?
Well, I don't feel qualified to do a cross reference of different, you know, teachers and great masters and things like that as to whether their experiences were basically the same or different. So I can't say that part. But when you talked about Buddha and said he had an extraordinary experience, I would actually dispute that.
Okay.
Yeah. Can I just zero in on that one thing?
Yeah, please.
And that I would say he had a super ordinary experience.
Okay.
Which is different than extraordinary.
Well, okay. I mean,
I want to say why.
Go ahead.
Because there's some actual possibility in any of the circumstances that you're describing for any of us, any sentient being, to recognize on the spot that the ordinary experience they're having is complete, contains all the possibilities of good living, magical circumstances, good companionship, good society. It's all embedded, and anybody could recognize it at any moment if they would just tune in.
Okay. I got you. I think that's fair enough, because when you say extraordinary, it makes people
once in a lifetime
fantasize about some fireworks show or I don't know what, elves or I don't know, some DMT style encounter. But, you know, this is in the Bhagavad Gita when Krishna decides to like take off his clothes, so to speak, and shows Arjuna who he really is.
Mm.
The commentary afterwards from Arjuna is, I'm sorry for any way I offended you. They were friends. They'd been hanging out. They were just pals. They'd been playing games together, joking with each other, doing normal stuff friends do. And then suddenly your friend turns into like this thing that's more effulgent than a billion suns with saints bowing down to it, you know, praying. And you're like, whoa, man, I'm so sorry. I called you a fucking idiot the other day. I was just didn't know. But I feel like that is pointing towards what you're talking about, that when you do begin to realize this place that you've been in, hanging out in, you know, doing all the things that you do in, is in as you once told me, a temple, there is some sense of like, holy shit, I can't touch anything ever again. Oh my God, I don't want to move. Are you kidding me?
I see
what I'm saying? And so it's not as though it's extraordinary in the sense that you've recognized it for what it is, which is from your that perspective.
But the idea that there's something very sensitive in the sacred world, and that responds very much to your level of awareness and care and consideration and intentionality.
Yeah.
And also that, you know, can open up gateways to a sublime sensibility.
Yeah.
So it's the same. This is just a metaphor. I hope everybody understands. I'm just using it as a metaphor. The sacred world is very tender, very sensitive. We don't want to go stomping through it with combat boots on. In this case, the stomping through it with combat boots means that we just are relentlessly operating from a klesha point of view, and our greed and our aggression are just rampant and unchecked. So we don't want to treat the sacred world that way. I agree.
Probably even worse. It's like a... Imagine, I don't know. Like, I was showing my kids videos of monkeys. They're so funny, and they're funny, and they're just so disgusting. They're cute and everything, but you know, I was showing them the monkey scratches its ass, smells its finger, passes out, and falls off a branch. Famous,
hilarious. That's so funny.
Its ass smells so bad it's shocked, and it falls off a branch. Or the classic, the monkey at the zoo shits in its hand and just nails a grandmother watching, just dead on, perfect, like professional baseball level zinger right at this grandmother. Like throws it at the oldest, most vulnerable person, the screams of people, they can't believe it. But imagine you take a classic monkey,
right?
Put
which is
monkey,
us in it, which is us in this case.
Exactly, monkey in the Sistine Chapel.
Right.
Suddenly gains awareness that it's been throwing its shit all over the Sistine Chapel. You know what I mean?
Yes.
That there is a sense of, but I think that's a little more precious than it needs to be. I'm just saying that this glimpse of a super mundane reality, even though it's a super mundane reality, a super normal reality, it still could be one of the most incredible experiences a person has in their lifetime.
And it invites an attitude of respect, consideration, and care.
Yeah.
It invites that. So the thing that we have to, in terms of coming back to the idea of tuning into our own mind and how it's operational, there's embedded in most of our minds what's called the seventh consciousness, which is the klesha aspect of the deeper rooted negative patterns and habits that we have. And they bubble up to the surface largely unconsciously. We're not really aware, like if we get into a rage on the road or something like that, or we, you know, or we have some kind of craving that's we can't manage, you know. So largely these kleshas are, you know, kind of driving the car periodically.
Yeah.
And it requires like some real intelligence about how to work with that reality, which is that those are unprocessed pieces of karma that we all carry in our seventh consciousness. And so therefore the respect for the sacred world invites us also to take a very respectful attitude towards our own neurotic patterns and towards our own how we work to, without judging, without condemning, to just refine ourselves more.
Wouldn't you say like there seems to be some direct relationship between getting any, even the slightest glimpse of this and those kleshas being subdued? I'm not saying eradicated necessarily like a magic wand or something, but there seems to be some relationship between this view and those, you know, I could think in my own life of just like, God, like, you know, you look back at these, you know, kleshas, which I think in our vernacular, we call them neuroses maybe, or like you know, clinical terms for these things. But a kind of schmaltzy relationship can develop with one's kleshas, a kind of embarrassing sentimentality towards one's quirks as being a kind of like, you know, a jagged edge that people just have to learn to live with. Something, this is just what I'm like. You know what I mean? Yeah. Or a real sentimentality towards
displaying, I'm with you.
Like people who like to fart in front of other people or something.
Yeah.
You know?
So,
like,
so consider this formulation, okay? Because this is a thread that I'm working on a lot right now, is this seventh, this kind of klesha consciousness, and then the nearly adjacent, just sort of ordinary storytelling mind, and the fact that they leak into each other.
Okay.
And all of a sudden, you're just telling an ordinary story, and you're in a rage, you know, or you're deeply saddened or craving something.
Yeah.
That this is our life. To become more aware of this is very important. So the first thing is to become aware of that without judging it. You can't, if you're ready to judge it and manipulate it, you don't even have the option of seeing it clearly.
Right.
But then the second thing is be aware of the tendency that we also have adjacent to it to justify it.
Right.
Okay.
Totally.
And then there's a third tendency, which is probably also could be pointed out, to feed on it.
Oh, yeah.
So there's the klesha, which is kind of weirdly innocent in a way. It's just what we are carrying. You know, it's like in your, open your knapsack and you see it in there. Then there's a tendency to sort of justify, oh, yeah, you know, I yelled at that guy because he was a schmuck. You know what I mean? And everybody thinks he's a schmuck and blah, 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 blah. And then on top of that, you start to get pumped. Your endorphins are pumping and you feel like, I like this feeling.
I'm going to be a dick.
So those three have to be dialed, recognized, and kind of, as you said, liberated or dialed back.
Let's talk about the justification part, because I think that's a
good one, isn't it?
That's a good one. Why? Why do you think people feel the need to justify a particular set of behaviors that keep manifesting in their lives as opposed to others. Like, I don't have to justify going to sleep. I mean, I'm tired. I don't have to justify eating. I'm hungry. I guess a better way. I don't have to justify breathing.
Yes.
I don't have to give an explanation to anybody about why I keep breathing in and breathing out.
Although yogis justify exaggerated breathing, that's for sure.
They sure do. But you know what I mean? Like, these things, as opposed to other manifestations of behavior, people, that isn't that red flag right there when you have some aspect of how you've been behaving that you feel the need to justify, if not to anyone else, to yourself.
So I'm drawn right back to junior high school when we talk about this. Remember you used to say wrong but strong?
No, but that's hilarious and dumb. Wow, that sounds like the dumbest person on earth said that.
Yeah, it's just like...
Wrong but strong, baby!
Or sometimes strong but wrong. You know, you could say it the other way around too. But the idea is it's a double, you know, you just double faulted in a championship tennis match.
You know, actually, did you know that's the new motto for ICE? If you heard that?
What is it?
Strong but wrong. ICE.
Terrible. Yeah. Sad.
Strong but wrong. That is sort of the definition of true fascism, isn't it? It's like
100%
strong.
And the third one is a big factor. Remember, feeding on that energy as if it was, you know, Malamars or something like that.
Right. Right.
Like there's some kind of pumping up, the same way you get pumped up by watching the Super Bowl or something like that.
There is definitely, I wonder, God, this is where we need all information in the universe. This is where we need access to the Akashic Records, because I need to know how many people have strong but wrong tattooed on their lower back, right above their ass. I'm going to guess more than 5,000.
And get the pictures too. We want documented proof. No AI, no Photoshop. We'll know.
Oh my God. Go on. Sorry. I've just never heard that before, and it is so funny these days especially.
And it really, you know, it really calls out a certain operating mode. And on top of that, I really think the energy people are, you know, we eat food. We eat air, you know, but we eat energy. We eat energy. Like if somebody's loving, like if you watch your kids, they're eating energy coming from you. It's almost like if you can see energy clearly, the same way you can see matter, you see that it's almost fungible. And we can get very full up on excitement and, you know, play and, you know, competition, all those things. And there is probably a healthier version of it, but it can become just a kind of toxic waste dump of like feeding on that. And all of us have it. We shouldn't think of it as just only certain people have. These are kind of general traits that we all share, I think, in a way, or tendencies, possible tendencies.
Yeah. Well, it's just the, it's just interesting because it's such an encumbrance, you know, the beginning of mindfulness or what you're talking about is, at least for me, it's a clumsy relationship with, you know, going in and out of awareness regarding things that you're doing that are probably not benefiting you or other people around you. And you sort of, the justification, it could manifest as I was angry, or it could just be you shove that part of your life under an imaginary rug and pretend it's not there. You try, you hide it from yourself or something. And then, but then you just begin to recognize that every time this thing appears, it fucks up your life. Every time this thing appears, it fucks up your life in subtle ways or incredibly powerful ways. And that's where the non-judgmental stuff becomes quite difficult, you know, like...
Yeah, difficult.
Very difficult, because how do you do that? Like, how do you stop ignoring some bullshit you've been up to, you know, your little game? You know, I love the Lojong slogan, don't do things with a twist.
Yeah.
I love that. And you've been doing things with a twist your whole life. You've been doing a little, you know, your little thing. And you start becoming increasingly aware of that little thing you do. And it's not a little thing you begin to realize. It's a manipulation. It's a it's a grift. It's, you know what I mean? It's not real. And it starts becoming appalling. It starts becoming like shit on your shoe, or, you know, like you start noticing how messy your room is and you can't stand it anymore. It's, you know, how do you not judge that?
Well, technically, we would call that renunciation, which is in the Kagyu lineage. And renunciation is the foot of meditation, as is taught. So, and the word in Tibetan, I always found this was interesting, translates somewhat to like nausea.
Ah.
Like at a certain point, you just have had enough of a certain thing, and then you kind of renounce it, and then the work starts. That's almost like the orchestral prelude, is that has to happen. There's a certain amount of exhaustion or you know, real regret that you have to keep going through this over and over again.
Right.
And then surrender, you know, that you go, and then discipline.
See, this is an interesting take on renunciation, because I think most people, when they hear renunciation, they think of it in terms of, I'm going to stop smoking, or I'm going to, you know, put away something that I'm going to stop eating sugar. You know, the things people do on Lent or whatever, you know. But from this perspective, what's going along with the renunciation is an aversion or a recognition. Yeah. So it's not like you're going cold turkey.
Lent, it would have to be bigger than Lent.
It seems like it's more like when you've been on a booze bender and you look at yourself in the mirror and you're all puffy and you stink and you're disgusting, and it just, you don't want to do it anymore.
Yeah.
It's not like you're just like, I love this thing and now I will stop because it's distracting me.
And then on top of that, you need discipline, because that habit is very strongly ingrained.
Yeah.
And that's where understanding karma is very helpful, that it's not, yes, it's empty fundamentally. All these patterns and habits don't have any real substance, but they are deeply ingrained at a relative level. And it's going to take some, you know, steadfastness. That's why there are vows, there are practices, there are schedules, things like that. There's, you know, there's teachers, and, you know, so that you have some chance of kind of shifting the habit.
Well, it's vile.
Not so easy to do.
I think the maybe the cruel joke of all of this is that you keep taking the collar off and then realize that you're putting it back on, you know, and it's somewhere in there. Just that alone feels so nuts, you know. It there's something so This episode of the DTFH has been supported by Ammon Tara. Listen, for all of you psychonauts out there, if somehow you missed Amanita, then you gotta check out Ammon Tara. Listen, I've loved psychedelics my entire life. It's something that has just always been there for me. And it's been very useful for a lot of different purposes. And I'd heard of Amanita muscaria, as many of you have, no doubt. I don't know. I just always thought it was probably bullshit, until I was sponsored by Ammon Tara and they sent me actual Amanita muscaria. Now, I'm saying actual because I've seen some of this shit at like Chevron's, and I will admit I might have tried it. And I don't remember what gas station was at. It's my fault. What am I doing buying fucking psychedelics at a gas station? What's wrong with me? Point is, the comparison between whatever the fuck that was and the Amanita muscaria the Ammon Tara sent me, night and day. Holy shit. It's incredible. It affects the GABA receptors. This is the same part of the brain that I think benzos work on. So my experience of it was this really wonderful, psychedelic, chilled out feeling that lasted around 5 hours. You know, I guess this is going to depend on dose. And what's really cool about Emmentara, and which I highly recommend and I should emphasize, is when you go on Emmentara, they have guides that you could check out. You know, this is real. That's the thing. This is a very powerful substance. And just because it's legal and you can order it online doesn't mean that it isn't authentically psychoactive. It's freaking powerful. So definitely, definitely look at the guides that they have there for the right dosing for you. The point is, these are purveyors of the best Amanita muscaria out there. And if you're somebody who in the past has maybe enjoyed benzos, but you also like mushrooms, this is a match made in heaven. It's a great alcohol alternative. I love it. And that's for real, not just because they're sponsoring me. If you're curious, you could check them out at www.amantara.com/go/Duncan and use code Duncan22 for 22% off. I recommend starting low, seeing how it feels for you, and just treating it like you'd recommend something to a friend with curiosity and respect. Thank you, Amantara. Hare Krishna.
It's disheartening.
So, yes, thank you. It's disheartening because you get this experience of your life if you hadn't been a raving, rabid asshole. Suddenly you go through weeks of not exhibiting this, whatever the klesha is. You know, for me, it's always been anger. But so you go through weeks, months maybe, where holy shit, what's going on? I haven't gone into an explosive rage in so long, and everything starts smoothing out, and your mind isn't being disturbed in the way it was. And then all of a sudden you feel that gnawing things start showing up again, and you're like, fuck, it's like COVID or something, or like, you know what I mean? Like, you're, fuck, how long is this gonna last? I thought I shook it.
Well, and
it isn't like COVID. I don't know why.
This is why there are certain encoded remedies, you know, like if you read the contents on the cough syrup, you know, like in the practices, there are encoded remedies. And like, for example, we say at Dharma Moon, we always say gentleness, precision, and letting go, which that formulation came from Pema Chodron.
Yeah.
Originally. So the idea of being gentler about the whole thing,
right?
Because if there's a certain roughness or harshness in how you got there, it's probably not going to be the best way to get out of there,
right?
You know, and then the precision aspect is something, you know, I find I'm very drawn to that aspect of teaching and really clarifying what exactly is somebody doing and how to do it, and you know, so that it's not just kind of like I call the absence of precision sometimes the Stevie Wonder and the pinata approach to meditation, which I realized when I said it has a certain valence to it. But the fact is that he's already blind, and then you blindfold him on top of that.
Okay,
of
first that, of all, I don't
spin
think
him around.
David, I'm sorry, I'm going to blow up your Stevie Wonder and the pinata thing. Not because clearly you hate Stevie Wonder and you hate blind people.
Well, but, wait, I love Stevie Wonder because he played on a song of mine.
I'm joking.
He played on a song of mine, Duncan.
I'm joking. You what? Yeah. Hold on, we'll get to that. Wow. When
so, Stevie, I love you if you're listening.
When was the last time you were around kids in a pinata?
Oh shit. I've been made. Long time ago.
Because you put a fucking blindfold on the kids.
Yeah.
So why does Stevie Wonder, it's anyone in a pinata is all I'm saying.
The joke is that if somebody's already blind, on top of that, you blindfold.
Oh, I'm the idiot.
On top of that, you spin them around. On top of that, you say, now go hit the target. And I meant to be talking about precision.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't rain.
No, it's too many questions. You're like, well, first of all, like, too many questions. talk about
it.
If you're
going to
talk about precision, make your analogy precise. Your analogy is confusing. And Let me fix it for you. I'm talking about thrashing around blindly. Ah, fuck. I don't know.
Let's reduce it to the real point, which is that gentleness means that we don't try to bang our way out of whatever trap we feel we're in. Soften into it. Precision means we have some clarity about the process.
You could save yourself a lot of time.
I just did.
Here you go. Yeah.
But there's a third one.
What's that?
Letting go, which is what we're about to do of this whole topic.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That one's scary too. I mean, yeah, the letting go part, it's like I was reading to the middle child, and we're doing these 5-minute stories before bed. It's great. These books that every chapter is 5 minutes. You know, parents out there, you know how that is. Your kid's going to pick like Moby fucking Dick if they can for the bedtime story because they don't want it to end. And so I'm reading, you know, and I realize he's not even listening to the story. He's looking at the pages because they change color when the chapter ends. And he's getting increasingly anxious about when the chapter ends. And then I just stopped. I'm like, you know, the whole time you haven't even heard the story.
Oh, God.
You've been worrying about the chapter ending, and you can't even enjoy me reading the chapter right now. And
well, look at you being a Dharma teacher to your own kids.
I know. Well, okay.
What a great little Dharma lesson that is. It's perfect.
Well, he didn't. I don't know if he heard it or not, but it made me think. I only brought it up because I was thinking, how many times have I done that? How many times have I been in the midst of a spectacular experience? And I know it's going to end. Or a spectacular experience has ended, and I can't let it go. I want to go back to that.
Well, this is why that's the third element. The gentleness, precision, and letting go is the third element. Because without that, we will simply attach to the method of liberation as our next set of imprisoning ideas.
Yeah. This is that famous thing Alan Watts said to Ram Dass. You know this. He apparently told Ram Dass, you know what, Ram Dass? You're attached to emptiness. And, you know, that's where it gets interesting. We've got this new baby, and it's fascinating, you know, seeing all the things that come hardwired into a new human are really interesting. The ability to breastfeed, to eat, and the startle response. So that thing, some people do it when they're falling asleep to this day, suddenly the baby throws their arms out, you know, like, like that. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
It's called the startle response. There's probably another name for it, but it's interesting. The things that are built in, the reflexes that are built in, but you start witnessing this response, I guess you could say, just being in the universe, which is this, that you keep trying to grab some shit, like no matter what, you just keep clutching and clutching and clutching. And that to me is the hardest thing to reprogram. That,
well, and it comes back to letting go, right? It comes keeps
yeah,
coming
that's
back
what I'm saying
to.
Yeah. Yeah,
letting go is you know, maybe the least technique of the three things that we iterated there. Like, you know, gentleness, you can use certain visualizations, certain analogies, you know, like a feather touching a bubble or something like that, you know, like when you label thinking in your meditation practice, come back to the breath, just to do that, like as if you were like, you know, doing with a child, you know, there's a way to like incur, to invoke gentleness. Precision is like, there's many metaphors you could use for that, but letting go, is harder to program in, isn't it? It's better like just to scare people.
Feels like the most ingrained.
It's better to just push them off a cliff.
Yeah, well, for sure. I mean, sometimes.
That's what I meant by letting go.
It's part of it, being a teacher.
You want to get the student back. So you know, we don't want the big letting go to happen too soon. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, my God. I tried this on my kid. Sorry, please. I learned my lesson. This is a true parental regret.
5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all of your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments, so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Moro Casino. America's Social Casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino. America's Social Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
We're at Disney World. The middle child is not wanting to go on certain roller coasters. My dad did this to me. My wife's dad did it to her.
Ooh, wow.
So the assumption being, not I want my kid to suffer. He's going to like it. Get him to go on the roller coaster. He's going to like it. It's fun. It's safe. It's a roller coaster. So we go on. I don't remember what it was. Tiana, I think. For those of you Disney people out there, you know what I'm talking about. It's got a drop at the end, man. And he's having fun until we get to that drop. And the thing is, like, we got...
Aren't we all?
Then the drop happens. He's like, what the... He didn't say this, but he's looking at me like, you... Wah! And then, you know, it was very sweet. The oldest is comforting in the ride ends. He was, like, fine. But after that was the problem, because any ride, we're like, no, we're going to go on Pirates of the Caribbean, doesn't have a drop. He's like, yeah, sure, Dad. And so that's what you're talking about. You can't do that. I learned you can't do that. So
I had a very similar experience with Ethan at a ride at Disneyland. But yeah, so letting go, you know, you could then look at, you could introduce the idea of mixing letting go with gentleness and gradually help somebody let go. You could mix the idea of gentleness with precision, right? That gentleness is not just this sloppy, you know, kind of mushy thing, that it has some kind of precision element to it. So between those three things, though, there's a lot to go on there.
You know that song?
We use that as a foundation of our teacher training program.
You know that song, Box of Rain, David?
No.
It's my favorite Grateful Dead song. I'm not sure which one wrote it, but it was for their dying parent. It's a song about dying. And my favorite line is, they chose Box of Rain instead of Box of Rain is supposed to be the earth. But he's saying, it's just a box of rain. I don't know who put it there. Believe it if you need it, or leave it if you dare. It's so cool. And it, you know, that kind of letting go, not just of, you know what I mean? Like of the whole thing. If you want it, it's there. Go ahead. Go ahead. Hold on. But if you see what happens, if you let go, if you leave it, Yeah, I get it. The gentle approach is better as long as you don't gaslight yourself into thinking you're being gentle when really you're being lazy.
Well, that's where the precision comes in.
Right. Right.
They intermingle. But it's three, you know, it's three good parameters to kind of use as a guideline for any kind of practice that you're doing.
What a great teacher you are. This has been such a joy, and I know you have another teacher training coming up. Am I doing another podcast with you for that thing? I love doing those things. It's so fun.
This is it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so maybe we can just say a nice word about it if you have one.
Well, I mean, you know, the truth is, David, that you, like, my life is infinitely better from being friends with you and having you articulating this stuff to me. I mean, it's for me, it's a slow boil, and but wow, you know, I'm always thinking about our conversations. It's wild how ingrained our conversations are in my sort of day-to-day assessing of reality and how many imaginary conversations I have with you. Maybe they're not imaginary, maybe we're actually. But yeah, I do hope people listening who feel drawn to what David's talking about take the leap, because and also I've met many people after shows and stuff who've done these trainings, and it's really had a big impact on them.
As have you. We do have an info session that I'm just going to talk about the program itself on February 10th. So maybe we can put a link to that in the show notes, and people can come and find out more about it. But the general idea is that I'm strongly inclined to help train the next generation of teachers. You know, it's definitely good to train students and practitioners. That's always, you always want to do that. But who's going to handle this? You know, my teacher, Drungpa Rinpoche, looked at me one time and he said, who's going to take care of these things these days? Like when I was very young.
Yeah.
And it was an aside, and I, at the time, didn't really register. But the idea that the wheel rotates, for me, it's more obvious. You know, I'm going to be 78 next month. It's unbelievable when you experience that.
That is amazing.
So just bringing along the next generation. So our Dharma Moon teacher training program is very much in that spirit of like helping to pass through what's really been helpful for me.
That retreat was so fun. What a great group of people you have there, too. It's really incredible. It's really exceeded all of my expectations, which are inevitable.
Well, we have another one at the end of April coming up.
Oh, really?
I'll send you the deets.
Please do. Yep. All right. Well, everybody, there you go. Dharma Moon teacher training program. Check it out. The info sessions are cool. There's a lot of what we just talked about there. It's not just like, I don't know, scheduling stuff. It's great. And you get to meet some of the people who are involved in Dharma Moon. And what is that again? February what?
10th.
4 days before Valentine's Day.
Yeah.
All right,
well,
great.
That's one way of looking at it. And 9 days before my birthday.
Wow. Okay. All right, David. Thank you so much. This is a wonderful conversation. Thank you for all you do.
And congratulations again. You had a girl. You've had four kids now. You're like a black belt dad, Duncan. You're getting the black belt.
You always feel like a beginner. It's always, but it's wonderful. I'm very lucky.
Yeah.
Thank you, David.
Yeah. Love to Aaron, too, and the whole situation there. It's
we got
I'm
divorced.
Sure these are going to be, you, what's that?
Well, we're divorced. I'm just kidding.
Is that what you mean by letting go?
Yeah, bye-bye. Okay. I'm off to Ibiza. Well, thank you very much, David. You're the best. And we will, all the links you need to find David will be in the down there if you're on YouTube, or in the description on Audio Boom, wherever you get your podcasts. David, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Duncan. Great to catch up.
That was David Nichtern, everybody. Check out his free live online event on Tuesday, February 10th. Links down below. God bless you. Please like and subscribe, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps, in line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.